This is Adam Mistis for the DIA. As we look ahead to the DIA 2016 annual meeting, this podcast features a conversation with the keynote speaker for that event, Dr. Larry Brilliant. Dr. Brilliant is currently chairman of the Skoll Global Threats Fund, whose mission is to confront global threats such as pandemics, climate change, water, nuclear proliferation, and the Middle East conflict. Board certified in preventative medicine and public health, Dr. Brilliant is also co-founder of the SEVA Foundation, an international NGO whose programs and grantees have returned vision to more than 3.5 million people in more than 20 countries. Dr. Brilliant, on behalf of all of the DIA members and staff and volunteers, it's an honor to speak with you. So thanks for taking time out of your day today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, you have spent your career solving just the ills of today, from overseeing the last smallpox cases to saving millions from blindness and building technologies for the future. Can you now discuss some of the new developments being done to eradicate pandemics such as Zika or Ebola? And how do these new developments relate back to the medical product development industry?
You know, there's a big dispute, I think, in the global health community about whether the risk of pandemics is increasing or decreasing over time. And technology and the way that we use technology has a huge part to play in making sure that the risks are decreased, because technology already plays a big role in increasing the risks. Most obvious one, you know, the 1917-1918 influenza pandemic. There were no airplanes in the sky. Yet the virus went around the world 4 times in 1 year. But there were no commercial airplanes of the kind that we know. There were military airplanes. So if you think about it now, if an incubation period for most pandemics are 1 to 4 days if it's influenza, or 2 weeks if it's Ebola or most of the other bloodborne or respiratory-borne diseases that we deal with, then it's possible you could get on a plane the day after a virus jumped species, the first human case occurred, and inside of an incubation period, you could be anywhere in the world. That gives you an idea of how technology plays a role in putting its, if I can anthropomorphize with you, putting its finger on the scale to the negative side. Other ways in which technology makes pandemics more likely is that we clear-cut forests in order to cultivate soybeans in Brazil. Bats that normally lived in those forests, other animals, are moving into what we think of as human territory. And a very old word from the 18th century, miscegenation, which literally means when two species cohabitate, is occurring. And over the last 30 years, somewhere around 36 viruses have jumped from animals, birds and ducks and chimpanzees and monkeys, jump from animals to humans.
You said 36? I'm sorry, over what period of time?
That's right, in the last 3 decades, 36. Well, you know the name of Zika and Ebola,
sure.
But if I add Lassa fever and Marburg and MERS and SARS and H7N9 and H1N1 and H3N2, we can go on for a long time.
Basically one a year, right?
That's right. Yeah. We're not even including the really exotic ones like arena virus, which has the lamentable characteristic of living in bats, but then becoming a bloodborne disease, as bats and animals share prey or share an animal. And once it gets into humans, it can become respiratory spread. And that's a frightening scenario. So technology, increasing the relationship between animals and humans and the speed of transmission, plays a negative role. But technology of the kind your members work on plays a positive role, and that includes antiviral. It includes point-of-care diagnostics. It includes new technologies for early disease detection. All of these things make me say that I'm optimistic that we can prevent pandemics, and I'm actually willing to say we can end pandemics. And here's where I go back to what I said earlier, was this big dispute in the global health community. Some people say that pandemics are inevitable. I like to say that outbreaks are inevitable. Pandemics are preventable. In fact, pandemics are optional. Outbreaks are inevitable. Pandemics are optional. But the option to avoid or prevent or stop pandemics are in our hands, your hands, the hands of your members, really, to the extent that they can work on better and better vaccines, better and better point-of-care diagnostics, better and better antivirals. And it's a little bit of a stretch, but not much, better and better technology for early detection. And that's what I'm going to focus on a lot, because the earlier that we detect a novel pandemic potential organism that has jumped species, in other words, the first case, the earlier we detect it, the more likely that we can exercise our option and make that pandemic not occur. That's the option that we have. We've got the option to limit that outbreak to one case or one outbreak, not to a pandemic. So those are some of the things, and we can talk about that in the context of Ebola.
Well, let's talk about smallpox, actually. You, as a UN medical officer in India, had some direct experience with the successful smallpox eradication program in South Asia. I mean, what worked from that perspective? Are there lessons that were learned from that experience that can be applied to future development and research into vaccines?
Yes, there are tremendous lessons. We couldn't have eradicated smallpox without Edward Jenner, of course, doing the most preposterous thing ever done, I think, in the biological sciences, which is to take the oozing pus from an udder of a cow that had cowpox and watch as it infected a milkmaid named Sarah Nelms, and then take the crud from the crust of a cowpox on the finger of Sarah Nelm and injected into a boy named Dan Phelps, and then believe somehow that this trans-special idea, this crazy idea that a virus could affect a cow, a nursemaid, and then protect you against another disease entirely, smallpox. This is crazy. This man must have been mad. But the idea that that would work and protect everyone who was thus given a cow, which is what the word vaccination means. Vacus is Latin for cow. And the idea that that could protect people from smallpox, that is a key idea in the history of science. But there were a couple of others that we don't even know about. So, for example, one of the most important ideas in the history of global health was something called Mr. Coffee. The idea that you could freeze-dry coffee allowed people to think, well, maybe we could freeze-dry vaccine. So you could bring vaccine to the tropics. You may have heard that yesterday India passed the highest temperature ever recorded, 150 degrees centigrade, 124 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, conventional vaccines would not survive a temperature like that, but the idea of freeze-drying the vaccine is a huge factor in being able to eradicate smallpox. And then at Wyeth Labs, a fellow named Ben Rubin, who was a researcher, tried to figure out how to take that freeze-dried vaccine and give it to people. And he took, we presume, his grandmother's sewing needle and whacked it, we presume, with a hammer and broke the end of it so that it had two tines, two little spokes, and that the area in between those two times was just enough to have a drop of fluid, a meniscus of fluid, and he computed what the diluent would have to be and what the dose would have to be so that bifurcated needle could take that freeze-dried vaccine that had been discovered 200 years earlier and poke people in the arm with it. In fact, more importantly, let farmers and peasants and sailors and merchants vaccinate each other. That's what led to our ability to come close to eradicating smallpox. And here's something else, and I don't work for Wyeth, and I'm not trying to tip my hat to them, But they then gave that patent for the bifurcated needle to WHO for free. They donated it so that we were able to get billions, billions of those needles and vaccinate tens of billions of people. That invention that one lab scientist came up with. So yes, there's a lot of great technology in global health.
Well, Time and Wired have called you a technology visionary. Can you talk us through your design of the disease surveillance network you kind of alluded to earlier?
Well, I think, you know, there's great inflation these days. So I suspect that if you're a technology observer, they'll inflate that to visionary.
Sure, sure.
I think for me, they're talking about my role in not in the biological technology war, but more in the computer side. And I started something called The Well, which was the first social network, the first digital neighborhood, so to speak, back in 1984. And I started that just as a result of an accident, like so many things in all of our lives. I was running a blindness program for the Seva Foundation in Nepal. And we had our own helicopter that had been given to us by a helicopter company in McMinnville, Oregon. And that helicopter crashed, or shall we just say that it came down to earth like a oak leaf in the fall. And it was in a very remote part of Nepal, and we didn't know how to get it out. And Steve Jobs, who had been a friend of mine, had given me an Apple II. This is a very early day for having an Apple in Kathmandu, as you might imagine.
Sure.
And I was able to get online with a modem that he'd given me, a Harris 300-quad modem, an acoustic modem, and get online to a satellite that was passing over and connect to a computer conferencing system at the University of Michigan and at Stanford, and we networked in a senator's office, the UN office, WHO office, the SEVA Foundation office in Ann Arbor, Aerospatiale in Paris, and the UN in New York, and we figured out what to do, and 24 hours later, we had a new engine, and 48 hours later, the helicopter flew out under its own power with the old engine underneath it. I'd never seen anything work so good in the UN as that. And, I came back and went back to being a professor at the University of Michigan, and that became the first social network back in 1980, The Well. And it was called The Well because my partner, Stuart Brand, had created the Whole Earth Catalog, and so we called this the Whole Earth Electronic Link. That was The Well.
Well, we were just absolutely thrilled that you are delivering the keynote at our annual meeting this year. Can you give us an idea of what you'll be discussing in that address?
Yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that are in my book, which is going to come out in October, which the publisher, HarperCollins, has given a title that I wouldn't normally have liked, but it's called Sometimes Brilliant, and
okay.
At least that's a somewhat self-deprecating name. But what I'm going to talk about is trying to create a feeling of optimism about where we are in this world. I mean, if you watch the political campaigns right now, if you look at the world outside, everybody's terrified, frightened of something, angry of something else. And all of our institutions are under attack in a way that we don't see the value in them. So what I'm going to do in my talk with you is I'm going to take a look back and look at some of the worst things in global health that have ever happened, plague and cholera and smallpox and blindness and the worst disease you could think of, polio and guinea worm, and I'm going to ask what made it possible for humanity to rid itself of these diseases. Because when was the last time you worried about smallpox or plague or even cholera, for that matter? What has helped us to rid us of those awful global threats, those pandemics? It has been some great people with amazing ideas, some of them preposterous, like Edward Jenner. I mean, think about it. Mm-hmm. The pus from the udder of a cow is what protected us from smallpox. It's you know, if you think about it, it'll drive you mad.
Yeah.
But some crazy things, like a fighter pilot the British Air Force had in the Second World War crashed. And when it crashed and the windshield broke, one of the pilots got the idea that you could take a piece of broken glass and put it in your eye and you could see again. And he was right. I mean, these are crazy ideas. So I'm going to go back and I'm going to say, let's look at the worst things that ever happened. How did we stop plague and cholera and smallpox? Who were the great people, the crazy and wonderful ideas? And what were the technologies that they invented or used? Like Ben Rubin, this idea of a bifurcated needle coming out of his grandmother's sewing box, that without which we would not have eradicated smallpox. We never would have eradicated smallpox without Ben Rubin's grandmother's sewing needle.
It's a great story. Well, I will anticipate and certainly look forward to your talk at our annual meeting. Thanks so much for today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Adam, thank you. Very nice talking to you again.
Dr. Brilliant's keynote speech at DIA 2016 will be Monday, June 27th at 2:30 in the afternoon. For the DIA, this is Adam Istis. Thanks for listening.